Succession number 31693, reel 5.
Mr. Robson, reel 5. We're talking on the last tape about you going to Whitburn for firing on the range. Can you tell me something about Whitburn? What was it like?
Pretty bleak. I mean, the billets there were the old Nissen huts. A lot of cold water to get washed in, I remember that. Whitburn ranges are still there, but in those days, and it's fairly bleak, and this is where we did our first live firing with the SLR, which had just come in, I think around about 59 when the SLR took over from the 303, and we did the live firing with the SLR self-loading rifle and the Bren gun, the light machine gun, which was still the section heavy weapon, which went through the Second World War, really, and it was a main section weapon right up until, if I remember, prior to us going to Borneo from Hong Kong, and that was the GPMG, General Purpose Machine Gun. So it was still being used in those days, and everyone did the live firing.
What ranges were you firing from? At what
distances
were you firing?
We would you would zero your weapon from 100 yards, which is getting the weapon zeroed into your eye from 100. Then you would go back, if I remember rightly, to 300. So you'd fire at 200, fire at 300, which is really the maximum that you fired at anyway. LMG. I think, if I remember rightly, I think it went back as far as 500 yards at Whitburn. And, of course, you were firing out to sea, over the North Sea from there. And, of course, the red flags used to go up, and they used to stop all shipping going past, the little cobbles going past the Whitburn Ranges in the sea there, which was quite fascinating, really.
And what kind of firing was it, in the sense of, you know, was it rapid fire or aimed fire or what?
It was all aimed fire at first. As I say, individual, just to get used to the weapon, because I'd never fired a weapon before like that. Although we'd had the old 303s when I was in the cadets. The SLR was much more fascinating anyway. But it was all single shots anyway. But the LMG, it was no more than one or two rounds rapid fire, and that was the maximum that you ever fired, because there was houses on both sides of the ranges, so you had to be careful, very careful. I can't remember if we touched on the SMG or not at Whitburn, the Stirling submachine gun. I don't think we touched them until we went to the battalion, when we did further training.
How long were you at Whitburn?
Just a week, if I remember rightly. Maybe 4 or 5 days. And then and during that time, of course, we were allowed out to go into Sunderland. On nights out, the only thing was we had to go out in uniform, boots, anklets, belt, bury, no civilians, which was quite unique then. And the nightlife in Sunderland at that time was quite good, although we still had to be back in barracks by 10 o'clock at night.
So after the time, a period of time you spent there, that you'd go obviously back to Bransworth.
Went back to Bransworth, finished off our training prior to going to the battalion in Honiton.
Had you been introduced to, you've mentioned the Bren gun, of course, with grenades and mortars, anti-tank weapons, had you been at
no,
the
stage? No, they were part of the advanced training when we went to the battalion. It was just the very basic training, really, which lasted 13 weeks.
So what date was it when you moved?
No, I'm trying to think when it was. So I was there in April, May. I think it was around about June. I went. We actually all got our suitcase, kit bag, and our weapon. And we actually marched from the barracks through Bransmith to the train station. No transport. Prior to us leaving the Bransmith training, going down to Honiton to join the battalion.
Did you get any leave at the end of your 13 weeks prior to going down to Honiton?
Yes, I think we had. I'm trying to think whether it was a week or 2 weeks. I can't remember whether it was a week or 2 weeks. And of course, going home, and we were allowed out in civilian clothes at that time. It wasn't until the latter part of the training, before going to Honiton, we were allowed out in civilian clothes. But again, these were inspected to see if they were suitable to go out in. You just couldn't go out in anything, and you always had to have a shirt and tie.
Quite a change, though. I was going to ask you whether you still had to pass the guardroom in your civvies.
Oh yes, when you went to the guardroom, you had to give your number, rank, name. You were given a number, what they call a booking out number, and you went out. And when you came back, you gave your number, rank, name, the number that you were given that would be in the guardroom book, and you also had to say that you were sober and properly dressed.
Had there been an end of course parade, final parade?
Yes, we did a final parade, both platoons. Sergeant Carr, as I say, was my platoon sergeant, and the other platoon that was on at that time, it was a competition all the way through the training, and we actually won the champion platoon. So our platoon sergeant at that time, Sergeant Carr, who was an ex-wartime soldier, was absolutely brilliant with us. And afterwards, from there, we went up to Spennymoor. There's the first pub in Spennymoor. Can't remember the name of it. And that's where we had our passing out parade drink. And that's where we all gelled together as well. And we had a brilliant night. With all the NCOs as well, we saw a different side of them from the previous 3 months.
Who took the parade?
I can't remember whether it was. It wasn't. I can't remember anybody coming in from outside. Obviously, the Sergeant Carr took the drill parade side of it. And went through all the various drill movements, and then we had the passing out. But I can't remember if somebody came in like they do now. They have somebody come in. I think it was probably just the CEO of the depot that took it. I think I was just pleased to get through the training without any hassle and without any problems, because it was hard. It really was hard.
Who are we joining at Honiton?
I joined at Honiton with the 1st Battalion, the Durham Light Infantry, although I joined the Light Infantry Brigade. All of the platoon that I was with, we all went to the DLI, the Durham Light Infantry, at Honiton, and there we actually we put into further training, which is another 3-4 weeks. This was called Advanced Infantry Training.
Just before we get to that, what was the name of the camp in Honiton or near Honiton?
I'll never forget it. Heathfield Barracks.
And was that in the town itself? Or?
No, it was just outside the town, about a mile from the town. On the main 303 road, in those days, used to run through Honiton and past the barracks, because they've got a bypass there now. But at that time, when we arrived, of course, it was all holiday traffic coming through as well. and the traffic coming through Honiton to go to the south, the south west, was absolutely horrendous, because it was just an ordinary road then. And as I say, there was the barracks was about a mile from Honiton itself. Can and Honiton was only a small village.
Can you describe the barracks? Was it similar to...
Very, very similar to the barracks at Bransmouth. All Nissen huts. As you went into the main square, on the left, in the main barracks, on the left-hand side was the guard room. On the opposite side was regimental headquarters. And about, I would say, 100 yards, the road went left, and another road went right, and it went round the battalion square. And it seemed as though all the barracks in England were built on the same design. The medical room was on the right hand side. Cookhouse was on the far side of the parade square. Then all the Nissen huts were all behind there, stretching for quite a way. And each company lines was very, very defined. And you weren't allowed in any other company lines apart from your own. I suppose it was to keep down the thieving. Because although it went on, if anyone was caught, and I'm talking about from other guys, they weren't averse to giving them a backhander, but they never ever handed them in. Law was taken by other soldiers, which is right in a way, but there wasn't a lot of thieving going on, because at that time you were not allowed in any other company lines at all.
What company did you join?
I joined the headquarter company after doing my what they call me advanced training, where we did our mortar training, grenade training, just to bring you up to spec to the rest of the battalion, because some of the weapons, as I say, you were just briefly introduced to, you never handled. It wasn't until you did your three weeks further training that we did all those then. And then at the end of it, I was actually allocated to go into headquarter company into the signals. And the funny part about that was when the adjutant, Captain McGregor Oakford, called me in and said I was going to the signals, I said, no, I've joined the DLI. I didn't realise that we also had a signal platoon in the battalion. So I joined up with my new comrades, put it, and I went on to do 3 months signals training with the battalion.
So the first 3-4 weeks was kind of rounding you off. You were getting to know the weapons that you would,
yeah,
or could be using. And then you went into, as you say, signal. Now, can you tell me, how was the battalion organised, from the point of CO and the various platoons and so on? What is the battalion organisation?
Well, at that time, the colonel of the battalion was a man called Colonel D'Arcy Irvine. One of the best COs I've ever worked with. He was absolutely superb.
In what way? What?
He was a gentleman. Always had a word with you. He was a disciplinarian, but not strict in that manner. The adjutant was McGregor Oakford, Captain McGregor Oakford. The RSM was RSM Morris Taylor. Company commander we had at that time at the headquarter company, again, ex-Waterhouse soldier, never got any further than Major. We never ever saw a lot of him. And then there was three rifle companies. Again, being a young soldier, I never got to know any of them. There was A Company, B Company, C Company, a support company concerning mortars, machine gun platoon, and of course the MT Company. And then, of course, headquarter company, which was made up of the Pioneer Platoon, Signal Platoon, and the Band and Bugles.
And how was the company itself split up? How many platoons were the two companies?
There was four platoons in each company. And again, because I'd newly joined, it was all new to me. I was still trying to take everything in, and what I was supposed to do. And of course, before I did our training that summer, we all went off to Aldershot to look after the Combined Cadet Force, and for 6 weeks we were under canvas and looking after Combined Cadet Force. And the SIG platoon at that time, we were all allocated to work in the officers' mess as waiters, because we had to wait on all the Combined Cadet Force officers. A lot of them were private schools. I'd never known how to set out a table before for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and how the correct way to serve at the table. If I remember right, it's serve on the right and take away on the left. I never knew anything like that. It's the first time I'd ever seen it. There was one funny part to it. We had a corporal called Brewis, Johnny Brewis, and he didn't actually do any waiting on, because he was a corporal. He supervised us. And one of the Combined Cadet Force officers asked for a finger bowl. We all looked at each other. We didn't know what a finger bowl was. So the next thing we know, Johnny Brewis went out to the back of the mess hall, got an old plastic dish, washing up dish, fill it with water, and then plunk it on the table in front of him. We all laughed about it, but didn't go down too well with the officers.
So that was obviously an interesting interlude in your...
It was very interesting. And of course, at that time there was a big to-do with the paras at that time, and it made the national newspapers, unfortunately, in that the advance party of the battalion, of which I was part of, there was quite a number of DLI men who were assaulted by paras because they reckon they ran Aldershot. The following weekend, the rest of the battalion arrived. So everybody went out into the town, in Aldershot, and unfortunately there was a big battle took place, and it became national newspapers the next day, the bottle battle of Aldershot between the paras and the Durham Line Infantry.
Were there any winners?
Durham's. Because we had a CO at that time, he was an ex-para, served in the war, in the paras, and he was the second in command. And I remember him saying, I shouldn't say this, but he said, I served with the paras, I served with the Durhams, I know who's the toughest. And even to this day, it's still talked about between the Durhams and the paras when you get together with them. Many years later, when I came out of the army and joined the prison service, there was a civilian storm in one of the prisons I was working at, and when he found out I was Durham's, he reminded me of an incident in 1960 in Aldershot, so we had a good laugh about it. So even many years later it was still talked about.
So that would be short in Lewis. Then was it back to Honiton?
Back to Honiton, starting off my training to become a signaller.
Can I just briefly ask, was the discipline even more strict or less strict than it would have been in the training depot?
It was still very strict, even though in those days. About every 3 months, everyone was had to parade on the main square with their civilian clothes in there on a hanger, and I'm talking me as a young junior soldier, 18-year-old, to senior soldiers, some who were privates, who weren't interested in promotion, who'd served, who were wartime soldiers, and they had to parade with their civilian clothes to be inspected by a junior officer, 19, 20-year-old, to ensure that these clothes were smart enough to be able to go walk out, as it was called then, to go into the town. And these were guys, some 40-year-old private soldiers, who were made for a young lad, a 20-year-old, to inspect them, make sure they were good enough. It was amazing. And then we used to get, if it was good enough and it hadn't been in any trouble, you were given what they call, we used to call it a PP, it's called a permanent pass. And with a holder of that permanent pass entitled you to wear civilian clothes to go out to the town. And when you went in, and we used to, in those days, used to work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday morning. Wednesday afternoon was always sports day. You worked Thursday, Friday. You worked Saturday morning, everyone. And you used to go for a 7-mile cross-country run every Saturday morning. And then at about 12:30, you were allowed to book out of camp to go out into the town, either into Honiton or into Exeter, which was the nearest big town from the camp. But you had to present your ID card and your permanent pass, signed by your company commander. And if you ever got charged, you used to lose that privilege if you were found guilty. And I never know anybody who wasn't found not guilty. And you lost that for 6 months. 3 months or 6 months. And then once that period was up, then you'd take your civilian clothes, and again you had to present it to the guard room. You weren't allowed out of barracks unless you had a collar and tie on and jacket, even in the summer. Jeans, they were just coming into fashion in those days, if I remember rightly. You weren't allowed to use them. You weren't allowed to wear them to go out of barracks.
So still strict and a very high standard.
Very high standard. Your shirt had to be pressed, your jacket had to be pressed, and your trousers, and your civilian shoes high polished before you were allowed out, and you were inspected.
What were the people of Honiton like towards you?
When we first went there, there was a bit of antagonism towards the battalion at first, especially after the hoo-ha at Aldershot. But when, if I remember rightly, there was a big potato blight around about October, when the potatoes were supposed, and we were given the job of going out and picking potatoes. and we had a week of that, week, maybe a fortnight, of picking potatoes, and never got paid for it. The money was paid by the farmers straight to the Ministry of Defence. And we used to get up early in the morning and work till late at night in the fields. And that was that went on, as I say, until the harvest was in. The farmers, they used to feed us. And I must admit, they used to feed us well. We had a particular corporal with us, Corporal Taylor, Yorkshireman, ex-KOLI. I'll never forget him. And he used to get a backhander from the farmers to make sure we worked, because we had a sit down one day because the farmer was going too quick. So we all decided that we weren't going to be pushed. And we all sat down and went on. That was the first time I'd ever been on strike. But we weren't reported, I don't think. We didn't get into trouble. But Corporal Taylor got us a better deal. And I'm sure he got a little backhander from the farmer. And after that, of course, there was a big bad floods of December, around about December 1960, the River Ex flooded its banks, and it flows into Exmouth. And we were called out, and we were saving the people of Exmouth from flooding, clearing the river. And it was, I'll never forget it, that was the first time I'd actually been a little bit aware. Somebody could have died in those floods. And after that, the people of Honiton, Exmouth, in Devon thought that Dermite Ivory was absolutely wonderful, because we actually did save lives, and we did a lot of work clearing people's houses out, and they couldn't thank us enough.
Of course, the Durhams had been down there in 1940, so you'd have thought that would have been a connection at least with the
I didn't know they'd been in there in 1940, no.
Well, you'd have expected the people would have known that they'd been there in 40, 20 years, which is 20 years prior.
Yeah. Well, the Durhams actually arrived at Heathfield Camp in Honiton around about 1958, 59, when they came back from Cyprus during the Eoka campaign. So I suppose they went a bit wild, I think, when they first arrived in Heathfield.
Did they invite you into their homes when the rapport was established?
Some of the guys who married local girls, but no, I mean, we weren't invited into the houses, although we were treated with more respect. And when we got the advance notice that we were being posted to Berlin, the people of Honiton actually got a petition together, asked for us to stay there. It was strange, considering that a petition out in 1960 wanting us out.